Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Tet Zayin Amud Aleph, two lines down. Amar Mar, Hashochet v'mukhne, Shchitato Kshera. Someone who does the Shchita with the Mukhne, with some sort of machinery, that Shchita is okay. V'atanya, Shchitato Psula. We have a Braita that indicates that it's problematic. Again, we discussed yesterday the different opinions with regards to what the Mukhne is, or how exactly it's working. According to Rashi, the knife is attached to the wheel that's spinning around, and then he sets up the animal next to the knife and then makes the wheel turn, and that does the shchita. Others suggested that it was a mechanism that caused the knife to go back and forth, and also the possibility that the wheel itself was a knife or had a sharp blade, and then it was able to cut. So here we have one braita telling us that b'diavad, that shchita is kshera, and another braita telling us that that shchita is psula. Where it says, Lokasha, ha bisarno de pachro, ha de bisarno de mayo. Depends what type of mechanism you're using. Rashi says, pachro is cheres, which means earthenware. Or in other words, it would be a potter's wheel. The other is a sarno de mayo, which would be a water wheel. So the difference would be between whether you used a potter's wheel, where it's driven by man, you either by foot or by hand spin the potter's wheel, and therefore it's koach adam, which means the individual themselves is driving the mechanism to work. And we're going to see later on in the Masechta that there's a demand for koach adam in the Shechita. On the other hand, if you're using a water mill or some sort of water wheel, there the water is driving it and not the individual. And for that reason, there's no koach adam, and that's why the Shechita fails. Now, based on that, you would say the reason that it's only bidiavad good by the potter's wheel is because of the fact that we're choshesh. We worry about the fact that you're going to do it with a water mill or a water wheel. Vibaitema, another alternative is, habahad bisarno de mayo. Both of the bright orders speaking about a case where we're dealing with a water wheel or a water mill. Vilokasho. And still there's no stira. Habikoach rishon, habikoach sheni. Depends if it's the original force of the individual or it's a derivative force of the individual. As Rashi notes over here, koach rishon is miyad kishnotel hadaf hamakevet hamayim. When the person opens up the dam that's holding the water, it releases the water to begin the mill moving or begin the water wheel to move. So as soon as he removes that dam, he lifts up the board that is damming the water. That water that rushes in is considered to be koach adam or koach rishon. So b'tchilat gilgulo shachat, and in the initial turning of the mechanism, that's when the shchita happened. That's mikoach adam shenatal adaf. That comes from the individual who removed the dam that's there. On the other hand, koach sheni is achar shegilgulo amayim et agalgal pam rishona v'shniya. After the water already turns it once or twice. It's interesting that Rashi says once or twice. But once it's turned it once or twice, we no longer associate the power of the water with the original action of the individual. We look at it more along the lines of groma. Now that it's just causation, it might be direct causation, but it's still causation, and therefore it's not considered to be koach adam, and we just assume that the water itself is what's the driving force now, and therefore it's not considered to be koach adam anymore. So Rashi sees the distinction of koach rishon and koach sheni as actually a time-bound factor, and you can actually see that in the upcoming Rashis, where he speaks about what the Gemara is going to say in the next section, and he says, "Bekoach rishon," he says over there, "shekashero samuch l'sfat hamayim," that you were very close or proximate to where the event took place, and then koach sheni is "shekashero birachok," that he put him far away. And so Rashi deals with something that we discussed in the Gemara in Baba Kama and other places about what the difference between groma and garmi is, and one of those definitions had to do with delay. That's what Rashi is indicating. Whenever there is a delay, that already is determined to be groma. When it happens immediately, that's considered to be attributable to you, or koach rishon. That's the way that Rashi explains the difference between koach rishon and koach sheni. The Yad Ramah in Sanhedrin, in the parallel sugya over there, gives two other possibilities as to what the definition is. The first is that the koach rishon is the waters that sit up against the dam. When you release the dam or pull the dam, those waters that are there are considered to be your koach, assignable to you. On the other hand, the koach sheni are the waters that were not immediately against the dam. Waters that come later on or come from further upstream, those are not considered to be koach rishon. That's one way that the Yad Ramah explains it, that when you remove whatever is the blockage there, things that were in contact with the dam, that's considered to be your chitzim or your koach, whereas anything after that is called to be koach sheni. Or the other possibility he describes is the question of whether the waters make it directly to whatever they're going to. Shemayim yordim b'shah shepina lahem derech lo amdu ad shegiu le'ish hakafut, that they went directly to the individual who was tied up. Or there's some movement, change, or something else that takes place between the time that you open up the waters and the waters actually do whatever they are going to do. The way that Rabbi Avraham describes it is, of a mamdu b'derech machmat davar she'ikvan, there's something along the way that calls a stalling or a changing in direction of the water. And then afterwards it continues to flow. And then they reach this individual. Then it's no longer considered to be his arrow or his direct impact on the individual. Those are different explanations of koach rishon, koach sheni. And the Gemara says, Damar Rapapa. The Rapapa brings, and this is the Gemara in Sanhedrin that runs in parallel, Hayman de kafte le chavre, someone who ties up his friend, v'ashkil alei bitko de mayo, and then he releases a dam of water onto him, umit, and he dies, chayav. Over there, he's considered to be culpable. My daima, why is that the case? Because gire didehu, dahani be, because your arrows is what affected him, that's what killed him. Dahani mile, that's true, bekoach rishon. If it's the original power, the original release that you had, aval bekoach sheni, groma ba'al mahu. But when it's koach sheni, that's considered to be causation and not direct action, and therefore one is not culpable in that case. Of course, it's not the right thing to do. Morally, it is terrible. But nevertheless, it isn't something where we can hold you culpable in terms of murder, even though you precipitated the situation. You tied somebody up, you released the waters, but as we're going to see in a second, the Baal Tosafot, we're not going to connect between those two actions. Now Rashi over here, in describing what it means, the Ashkale Bidko de Mayo, that he pulled away the board in front of the waters, Rashi over here gives two explanations, and he seems to combine them almost. One of them is that the Bidko de Mayo was that it deflects the water. You put the board there that the water's pouring, and you deflect the water with the board. And then Rashi also seems to speak about that you put a hole in the dam that allows the water to flow through. Rashi seems to be indicating both items, but you could see both of them being an issue, which is the release of the dam, that first action being a koach rishon, or the placement of a board there that deflects the water towards the individual, that also the first waters that are deflected by that action, you could be held culpable for. They could be considered chitzav, your arrows. So therefore, in the case where, again, using the same definitions we used before, for Rashi, that means that if immediately upon releasing the water, the person's affected by it, and that's how Rashi describes it, we read that before in the Rashi, that he tied him up immediately next to where the water is going to be released, and then he releases the water, and it immediately hits him, that you're going to be responsible or culpable for. On the other hand, if he is set up a distance away from the water, and when you release the water, it doesn't affect him right away, but it takes time to get there. That already is considered to be grama. Again, for the Yad Ramah, the waters that were touching the board, the waters that were right up against the dam, when you picked up the dam, those waters are considered to be your koach. So even if it takes time to get there, or if it affects the individual, not immediately, but a little bit downstream, that's still your responsibility, because those waters, when you picked up the board, that's your responsibility. Those waters are a direct result of your action. And they're considered to be chitzav, and that you're responsible for. The waters that come afterwards are already koach sheni. And again, we saw the second view in the Yad Ramah, which is whether there's something that causes a delay or something that changes the waters along the way, where there's another intervening factor between the time that you release the waters and the waters hit this individual. The Baal Tosafot just bring over here three different areas where this halacha has application. First of which is, if a person tied up another individual, if he ties him up in a place where sofa mayim lavo, where water eventually will come, or sofa shemesh lavo, or the sun will eventually get there, then the person is not culpable in that case. The distinction the Gemara in Sanhedrin makes is between tying somebody up in the sun and placing them in the sun, tying somebody up and putting them where the water is, where the item that is the danger or will kill them is already extant. In that case, you're held responsible for that. On the other hand, if you tie the individual up and then only later on does the sun come, or only later on does the water come, in that instance, you're not held culpable because the killing aspect was not there when you tied the individual up. When you tied them up, there was no hezek. There was nothing that could injure them at that point in time. In the end, it came about that it happened to come there, and even though it was inevitable that it was going to come there, that's still not considered to be direct culpability for you, and you're going to be patur in that case. The cases where you are chayav is, as the Balei Tosfot say, is shehitchila hechezek kevar, where the damaging item, or the item that will kill, is already there, extant, in place. It's where you don't allow a person to get out of a fire. They're in a place that's burning up, and you prevent them from escaping. So over there, the fire, the killing item, is already extant, and you're preventing them from leaving, even though it's like a passive action. You're not actively putting them in the fire. You're stopping them from leaving is enough because the fire is already extant. Or the same thing, if a person's in water, and you don't allow them to come out of the water, so even though, again, you didn't do anything actively, you were just preventing passively the person from coming out of the water, nevertheless, that's considered to be direct action. Culpability will be assigned to you because the water or the eish already extant. So that's one distinction that Tosafot makes. That's based on the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The second thing that the Balei Tosafot say is that if sof hachom lavo, sof hamayim lavo, in an instance where the killing item is only going to come in the future, there you're patur. And Tosafot adds, afilu kafato b'makom acher. Even if he tied him up somewhere else, veheviu sham, and then you bring him to that location. So you tie somebody up in a house, then you carry them outside and put them in a location where the sun will eventually get. You put them in a location where eventually the water will come. So in that case, you're not going to be held culpable because even though you did something actively with him, you tied him up, but then you actively moved him, but you moved him to a location where the damaging item was not in place. Although then Tosafot qualifies that and says, according to the one who says that ishom mishum chitzav, that the mazik of eish is considered to be like you shooting an arrow, in that instance you will be held culpable in this case, because as Tosafot points out, by isho mishum chitzav, for instance, you have a fire that's burning. If you do not control the fire that's burning, and then it begins to spread in a normal fashion, in what could have been anticipated from a normal environmental circumstance, so there you're going to be held culpable because it's as if you shot the arrow. It's as if the fire was your arrow. Tosafot points out that that's not only true about the fire, it's true about objects. If you take someone else's possessions and put them in the line of the fire, then you're also responsible because it could have been anticipated that the fire would reach there, and that's also considered to be your arrow. And similarly over here, if you tie someone up and then put them in the way of danger, then you're moving them to that point is the equivalent of you shooting an arrow, and therefore you're going to be held culpable. And that's what he says over there. If it's isho mishum chitzav, then if you tied him up and moved him closer to the damaging object, that would be something that you're responsible for. On the other hand, if you hold isho mishum mimono, then in that instance, you would not be held culpable. And the Chazon Ish points out that that's different than the cases of Koach Rishon and Koach Sheni, where after the first action, it is disassociated from you because there you're not creating the mazik. Whereas over here, what the Balei Tosfot are describing is that you are the one who is miyatzer, the Koach. And since you're the miyatzer Koach, it's assigned to you or you are culpable for it, even beyond the first moment of action, as long as it is something that could have been anticipated, like a ruach mitzuya. And then he brings the last distinction, which is mikom makom, halcha potur. Here, your potur, shebishashe v'yosham, lo ayas sof hamayim lavo. Over here, the reason your potur is because there's no nezek that will come from the position that you put him in, ilav deshokil acharkach, until you took off the bitka, took off the dam afterwards. And then when you take off the dam, already, that's not chayav because that's already koach sheni. And he compares it to a case in the Gemara in Sanhedrin where the Gemara says, if someone shoots an arrow and his friend is far away, but there is a shield in front of his friend. If he shoots the arrow, the shield would have protected his friend. There's no damage that could be done from the release of the arrow. In the meantime, he races over to his friend and pulls the shield away. And then pulling the shield away, now exposes him to the arrow. Over there, the Gemara says you are patur. Again, patur val asur. It's morally problematic. It's definitely something where you are a direct cause of the death of the individual, but it's not considered to be your koach. And that is that you have two independent actions, each of which by themselves is not a killing action, but combined they do kill the individual. So first of all, shooting the arrow, by itself would not have killed the individual because there was a shield in front of him. Removing the shield from in front of the individual by itself does not kill the individual. The combination of the two items is what kills him. But each item independently doesn't. And when you took the action in each one of them, you didn't do anything that was direct damage. When you shot the arrow, he was protected. When you removed the shield, you didn't do anything. All you did was remove a shield. In that situation, you will not be culpable. But the Baal HaTosfot would say, that's exactly what we're speaking about over here as well. The case is he ties him up in harm's way, meaning that without any additional action, the warder here is not going to inherit this individual. So tying him up in of itself is not dangerous and is not going to kill him. Removing the dam also would not have killed him if he wasn't tied up there. So now if the person ties him up and then removes the dam, we're not going to combine the two to say, oh, it's all him, it's his action. When he placed them there, it was safe. So he didn't do anything wrong. When he lifted up the dam, yes, the first waters were his problem, but any water after that's koach sheni, is grumma, and therefore he's not held culpable for that. So when it does the killing, it wasn't his koach or his direct koach, and that's why he's not culpable. So that's how Tosafot frames this out. As you can imagine, these halachot have a large impact on many tshuvot. I brought you a sampling of those tshuvot in the Makarot that I sent out, including the Shut Achiezer, which speaks about it with regards to electricity. Is the turning of a switch creating a circuit, completing the circuit, or breaking the circuit? How do we view that? And he thinks it's very similar to the removal of the dam, the Asarat HaBidka, which is a Koach Rishon. And therefore, if you do that on Shabbat, you're going to be liable for Melechet Shabbat because you're the one directly causing the flow of electricity. The Shut Har Tzvi asks about opening up windows next to a garden or a house where there are trees and plants on Shabbat. And over there, he thinks that it's a Koach Sheni, because since the plants are not directly up against the window and the air that's coming in takes time to reach them, or whatever it is coming through the window takes time to reach them, then that's considered to be koach sheni. Similar to what Rashi says, that when there's a delay, that's already called koach sheni in grama, and that's not problematic. He also, in another tshuva, thinks that maybe placing hot soup on a plata that's going to come on with a timer first suggests that maybe there should be mutar, but then based on what we saw here on the Baal HaTosafot, that when it's something that is sofo lavo, something that will happen in the future, we assume that there is problems with that. And that's the same thing over here. In the future, inevitably, the timer is going to trigger the electricity, and electricity flow is already there and cause the plata to go on. And therefore, when you're mikarev something towards an item that will eventually come there, we say yishom yishum chitzav, and there is liability for that, and therefore it may be problematic on Shabbat. And on the flip side, he suggests that maybe turning on a light for landing candles on Shabbat may not be enough because that's just considered to be grumma and not a real action of lighting candles, somewhat at odds with what we saw in the Achiezer. Although over here it's the mitzvah aseh versus over there where it's a restriction of melacha. And he also speaks about the possibility of milking cows on Shabbat and putting the milking machine on the udders, even though they're not on but will turn on later. Maybe also there it's problematic because of the same problem in the Baal HaTosafot, whereby if you bring something to the item that is inevitably going to happen, then you are considered to be liable for that. And Rav Avadya Yosef in Yechaveh Da'at discusses about opening up a hot water tap on Shabbat. And even though the water that you're draining out is not problematic, but the new water that comes in is being boiled by that which is in the boiler or that which is in the Dud Shemesh. And that is considered to be Koach Rishon based on what we're seeing here. The opening of a tap is koach gavra, at least for the first part of the water that comes through. And last is a tshuva from Avadya Yosef about machine-made shmura matzah, whether you can have lishma when an individual pushes the button to start the machinery going forward. And based on our Gemara here and the psak of the Shulchan Aruch, that once somebody puts something in motion, that which continues in motion, as long as it's from that original koach adam, is still assignable to you, then maybe over here too you can create the lishma in that way. Although he does favor getting handmade shmura matzah where the individual can imbue every action with the lishma rather than relying on this aspect of the pushing the button to start the machinery. Even though he thinks it probably is okay, he says there are many gdolim that don't love it, and therefore he favors handmade shmura matzah to get the lishma. So that is really a part and parcel of this sugya of koach rishon, koach sheni, and the assignability of the action to the individual when there's machinery involved. Alright, so now, Gemara continues. Yotiv Rav Achorei de Rabbi Chia. Rav was sitting behind Rabbi Chia. Rabbi Chia Kamei de Rabbi. And Rabbi Chia was sitting in front of Rabbi. It's like a classic setup. You have Rabbi, who is the Nasi, the Gadol Ador. Rabbi Chia, who is one of the senior Talmidim of Rabbi, he is a Masader of the Breitot. and you have his nephew, Rav, who is sitting behind Rabbi Chiya. And we know there, in the beginning of Sanhedrin, Rabbi Chiya tries to get his nephew, Rav, to be ordained by Rabbi. There's a big interaction between them here, and then eventually Rav leaves for Bavel and becomes the great Rav in Bavel. But here you have them set up all in front of Rabbi, learning from Rabbi. Vika Amar, Rabbi says, Minayin l'shchita shehu betalush. How do you know that shchita has to be done with something that is detached? This is based on the bright that we saw yesterday, Machloket, Rabbi and Rabbi Chiya, as to whether you need a detached item to do shchita. We concluded at the end of the Gemara yesterday that Rabbi Chiya believes that b'chatchila, you can even use something mechubar. Rabbi says that b'diavad, talush ulesov chibro is okay, but b'chatchila you shouldn't use it. And if it was chibro mi'ikaro, if it was something that was attached from the outset, meaning that it was always attached, like a tree that grows, or bedrock that was used, that's pasul de gamre, and that was the distinction we left off with regards to Rabbi's position as to when it's kasher b'diavad and when it's even pasul b'diavad. So now Rabbi is dictating his position, which is, how do I know that I'm right, that shchita has to be done b'talush? Shenamar, because the pasuk says, by the akeda, v'yikach et amachelet lishchot et beno. He took the knife to do the shchita on his son. Now, the Baal Yatosafot over here, it's also mentioned, we saw this in the Gemara Menachot on Pei Dalid. What is the source, first of all, from this Pasuk? And number two is, what's the interplay here between Chulin and Kodoshim? Tosafot notes that there is an issue, which is that we learn both the din of Chulin, Shchita, which is what we're discussing here from the Akedah, to teach us that the knife has to be detached. It can't be attached. We also learn from the Akedah that you have to use a Kli. But the Gemara only says with regards to Kodoshim that there's a necessity for Kli. On the other hand, with the case of Talush, Gemara says it applies to Kodoshim and to Chulin. So Tosafot is somewhat bothered by how do you learn from the Akedah, both of these items, both of them are deriving from the same place, and you're saying only one applies to Kodoshim and the other one applies to Chulin and Kodoshim. How do you know to differentiate? The Omer Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbeinu Tam says, Linin Talush, Gamina Nami Achulin. We learn that from Chulin, Midachtiv, Lishchot et Beno, Veloch Dichtiv, Lishchot et Ha'ula. The fact that the Pasuk formulates it or frames it as Lishchot et Beno, when Avram went to kill his son, rather than to say that he went to cut the Ula, that's an indication that it applies outside the world of Kodoshim. If it wanted to stay in the world of Kodoshim, it would use terminology that is uniquely associated with Kodoshim, the Lashon of Korbanot. It doesn't use the terminology that is throughout the Parshia Vekedah, Lashon of Kodoshim, Lashon of Olah, Korbanot, over there it uses Ben instead of Olah. That's indicative of the fact that this din here has application to Chulin and not just to Kodoshim. And the Tosafot says that comes from Umrichtiv Vayikach, Velo Yichtiv Vayachin. The fact that he says it, he took it, and not that he prepared it, tells us that you use Talush. That it has to be something that is separate, something that is detached. Others focus on the fact that the beginning of the pasuk is Vayishlach Avram et Yado lishchot et beno. The fact that he did shlichut yad in order to do it, then that indicates that the machelet was something that was detached already. Or the Rashash even suggests that it comes from the earlier part of the perek about the akedah, which is that it starts out Biyakach v'yado et eishvet machelet v'yichush neyam yachdav. The fact that he carried the knife already is an indication that it is something that is talush. So it doesn't even come from this puzzle. This puzzle teaches you what he did the shchita with the machelet, but already the fact that he carried the machelet earlier on shows you that it was detached. So from different parts of the story over here, it seems to be clear that whatever instrument Avram was using was something that was detached. On the other hand, the necessity for a kli, lo shayach lemelech b'chulim ela b'kodoshim. Necessity for a kli is only something that's necessary by Kodoshim, Kashar Avodot, the Ba'u Kli Sharet. Because contextually, in the world of Kodoshim, all the Avodot require Kli Sharet. So why should this be any exception? And it makes sense that if you're going to demand Kli, that will be in the world of Kodoshim. And the fact that it terms the knife a Ma'achelet and doesn't deem it a Mechatech, a cutter, that shows you that it has to be a kli and not just something that is sharp and can do the cutting. So Tosafot, he learns all of this out of the language here. Amalei Rav, the Rabbi Chiya. So Rav leans over to Rabbi Chiya and says, "My kamar, what did Rabbi just say?" Rashi discusses here a number of different possibilities as to what the scenario was. One possibility is that he didn't hear what Rabbi said at all. Other possibility is he heard the pasuk that Rabbi quoted, but he didn't know in what context it was quoted. Or he heard the pasuk and the din and he wanted to understand it better. What is the connection between the din that we're deriving and the pasuk? So those are all possibilities as to what Rav was querying of Rabbi Chiya. Because Rabbi Chiya is right in front of Rabbi and Rav is behind Rabbi Chiya and he missed it. Or whatever reason, he didn't understand it. So he's asking his uncle, Rabbi Chiya, please tell me what he's saying. Amalei, vav dichtiv ufta kamar. It's like a vav that is written on a log. So now, the Rashi here again brings a number of explanations. First one is that when you write a vav on a log, that it's as if you did nothing. It's a meaningless type of action. That could either be because the grain of the wood has etches in it or lines in it. And if you draw in the direction of the grain, a vav, you haven't done anything that is significant because you're just writing along the grain of the wood. Or even if you write against the grain of the wood, because of the nature of the grain there, when you write it, it's not going to be a straight line. It's going to bump up and down. You'll get something that has spots or dots along it. You're not going to get a full vav. The other possibility Rashi brings is the fact that the charitzim themselves, the lines themselves, the grain of the wood itself, that's called a vav. Or the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom phrases it is, klomar, ma'oto bikua ein bo yitaron l'chol davar. Just like those lines or those grains are not advantageous in any way. Avdarazeh ein bo raya. So to this pasuk has nothing that differentiates it from other psukim or doesn't bring you any proof to what you're saying. And Rabbi Chiya is basically dismissing what Rabbi said. He's saying to Rav, this is a meaningless statement. What he's saying is incorrect. And this, as Rashi points out, is Rabbi Chiya l'shitato. Rabbi Chiya disagrees with Rabbi, and he believes that shchita does not need to be done with something that is talush. And that's why he's saying to Rav, it doesn't really make sense what he's saying. So if Rav didn't hear the drasha at all, he's saying to him, don't worry about it. It wasn't anything significant. If he heard the pasuk and he didn't hear the drasha, so then he says to him, don't worry, the drasha that he's making from the pasuk is incorrect. Or if he heard both pieces of information and said, how do you connect between the two of them? He's telling him, I don't think there is a connection between the two of them. But Mar says, Vakra Kamar. Wait a minute, Rabbi's not just bringing a din, he's bringing it from a posuk. What are you going to do with the posuk? So Rabbi Chiya says, Kra Ziruste de Abraham Kamash Malan. The posuk's not teaching us a din in Shechita, it's teaching us about the character of Abraham. That Abraham was zealous in his actions over here. He did it with zeal. That's because he prepared ahead of time a knife. He could have just been reliant on the fact that when he got to the location, Har Moriah, he was going to do the Akedah, he'd find a sharp stone, he would find a sharp reed, he would find something that he could do the Shechita with. The fact that it says Vayikach et ha-machelet means that he already had prepared a knife. He brought a knife with him. He anticipated having to need the knife, and he wanted to be ready right away. And so when it says Vayikach et ha-machelet, that's reflecting on Avram's character as to how zealous he was in performance of the command of Hashem. That's what Rabbi Chiya learns from the pasuk, and Rabbi Chiya clearly disagrees with Rabbi with regards to whether you need talush for shechita, and that's what we saw in the Braita yesterday. Now over here, Rabbi Chiya could be either saying this because he argues fundamentally on Rabbi, and he believes that you can use something that is mechubar, or it could be that Rabbi Chiya is saying that even if you want to learn this from the pasuk, that's not something that's available to you to learn from these psukim because it's Kodem Matan Torah. In Kodem Matan Torah, we learn things about behavior and how to act, like Zrizut, but we don't learn about particular dinim from something that's before Matan Torah to items that are post-Matan Torah. So it could be that the explanation of why you can't learn from the pasuk is not, there's fundamentally a difference in whether you can use Talush or Mechubar, but more along the lines of that there's a more principled argument as to whether you can learn something from pre-Matan Torah. So Amar Rava, pshitali, it's clear to me, Talush ulusov chibro le'inyan avodat kochavim havi Talush. He is making a distinction that we already made at the end of yesterday's daf, which was that there's a difference between something that is always attached versus something that was detached and then reattached. So, for instance, if you're dealing with an item that was uprooted and then reinserted into the ground. So, for instance, a reed that is growing, that's called mechubar meikara. That's something that is attached, was always attached, and it's considered to be mechubar lekarka. If you then cut the reed and then you drive it into the ground, that's called talush, or the sof chibro. So what Rav is pointing out, within the world of Avodah Zarah, it's clear to me that, first of all, if something was mechubar meikaro, then it doesn't become asur when it's worshipped. In addition, he says, if you have something that was talush, that was taken out of the ground, and then reinserted into the ground, then if that's worshipped, that has a din of being talush, and therefore it will become a sur like a avodah zarah. Damar mar, a mishtachavel abayit shelo asaro, someone who bows down to his house makes it a sur. V'isakadatcha v'mechubar, a house in general is something that was mechubar originally. You quarry out the stone from the bedrock that you're going to make the house from, and then you rebuild the house on something that makes it attached to the ground again. That's something that was talush, ulusov chibro. And it says here, if you bow down to it, you make it into avodah zarah, and it becomes asur. If you classify it as a mechubar, then the house would not become asur, because the pasuk in Devarim says, Elohim al ha'arim, that their gods are on the mountains. The lo ha'arim, Elohim. The deal from the pasuk is, their gods are on the mountains, but the mountains are not their gods. So that means that if someone worships a mountain, they're going to be culpable for avodah zarah. They're going to be held accountable for the fact that they worship the avodah zarah. What they can't do is make the mountain into something that's a sur. They can't change the fact that the mountain is there, and they can't make it into avodah zarah to the point where someone can't walk on this mountain, can't utilize this mountain. That's something that's mechuber lekarko. So if a house was classified as mechuber lekarko, when a person bows down to it, they wouldn't have impacted it. The fact that they consider it to be avodah zarah shows you that they classify it as being talush. So that's Rova makes says, I clearly understand that there is this distinction within avodah zarah between mechubar meikara and talush lusof chibro. Tosfot over here points out, lo bay le'tui hocha plukta de Rabbi Yosi v'rabbonon. The Gemara doesn't bring here the machlok between Rabbi Yosi and Rabbanon de pligei b'mishtachavei le'ilan, when bowing down to a tree. Tafil Rabbanon de sharu hotam, because even the Rabbanon over there say it's mutar, hainu davka ilan shin nishrash v'yotzei min hakarka. That's only a tree that is already rooted and come out of the ground. V'choshiv k'mechubar meikara. It goes back to being classified as mechubar meikara. The question over there, in the terms of a tree, is whether there's tfisat adam. If man has interaction or been a part of whatever has happened. If there's tfisat adam, then it becomes asur when you worship it as a avodah zarah. If there's no tfisat adam, then it doesn't become asur. So by the case of a mountain, it's clear there was no tfisat adam. In that case, it's not going to become asur if someone worships it. By the house, it's clear there was tfisat adam, because the person built the house, even though, again, it was originally mechubar, and now it's mechubar again, but there was tfisat adam, and that's why the house is asur, because that's talosh l'sof chibro. The tree falls somewhere in between that. And that goes back to the machlok we saw in Rashi and Tosafot yesterday, with regards to putting in a seed in the ground. Is it only when there is a seed that falls naturally and the tree grows do we classify that as being mechubar the karka, mechubar mikaro? And there, you're not going to make it able to make it into avodah zarah or make it asur bana. Or is it even when someone plants a seed in the ground, since all you did was plant the seed, that's not considered to be tfisat adam, and therefore the tree that grows from it is also considered mechubar the karka. So over there, Rabbi Yossi and the Chachamim argue about the status of a tree. And over there, there's a machloket Rashi and Tosafot exactly where that distinction lies. And in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah on Daf Memhei Amud Bet, Rashi and Tosafot have a similar machloket to what we saw yesterday, which is Rashi over there seems to indicate that if a person plants a seed, that's called tfisat adam. And that would still be considered to be talosh l'sof chibero, and it would be asur in Avodah Zarah, according to Rabbi Yossi. Whereas the Bali Tosafot say that if you plant a seed, that's not called tfisat adam. Tfisat adam is when you take a sapling, you take an item, and you replant it somewhere else. That's called tfisat adam. But if you put a seed in the ground, that's not something that's called tfisat adam. So what Tosafot's pointing out is that the Gemara is not going in that direction, because even the Rabbonon, who are matir over there, that's only an ilan shenishrash v'yotzei min hakarka. That's called choshuv mikiaro. But otherwise, they also consider a tree to be talush l'sof chibro. But again, there is nuances in that machloket that we already mentioned yesterday, and it parallels the opinions of Rashi and Tosafot in a machloket in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Memhei Amud Bet, as to what is considered to be talush l'sof chibro, or what's considered to have tfisat adam. So Rava says, with regards to Avodah Zarah, I'm very clear. Le'inyan hechsher zraim tanayehi. With regards to hechsher l'kabel tuma, it's actually a machloket tanaim, and it's not as clear. It's not. We have a Mishnah in Machshirim. We've mentioned this before. Hakofe ka'ara ala kotel. Person turns over a bowl on top of a wall. Bishvil shetudach. He wants the bowl to be washed by whatever water or rain that comes. Harizeh b'chiyutan. That has a classification of chiyutan, which means that it is good. The waters that emanate from this will be good enough to be makshir de kabel tuma. B'shvil shelo yilakeh akotel. On the other hand, if he places the bowl there to protect the wall from being damaged by the water, eino b'chiyutan. It is not classified as something that can be makshir de kabel tuma. So just in the way of background, the pasuk says v'chiyutan mayim al zera v'nafal meniv latam alav tamehu lachem. That when you place water onto food items or grains, that is what's makshir at the kabel tuma. There the pasuk uses the word yutan, but spells it yitain. And the Gemara's darshan from that it has to be yutan dumia de yitain. Just like yitain, which is the active verb, is only done if the person wants it to happen and desires it to happen. That's ki yitain. So too ki yutan. When it happens passively, it has to be with the approval of the individual, with the acquiescence of the individual. So again here, the rain is coming down. You're not the one putting the water on it. The rain's going to happen by itself. Question is, what's your feeling about the water that's coming here? And as Rashi notes over here, the Mishnayot and Machshirim make it clear that there are two points in time where you can make that decision to have it be that it is something that you are favorably inclined towards. So first of all, the easiest part is when the water is actually on the item. When you have water or dew or whatever one of the seven mashkim is on the item itself, if at that point you're happy with the result that you receive, that is something that is makshir the kabel tuma. So as long as it's still wet and the water is still there or the liquid is still there, and you think, wow, this is a great thing, that's enough to create hechsher the kabel tuma. There's also, and Rashi brings the drashot from the Mishnayot and Makshirim over here, which is that earlier on, when the original water is falling or coming into the situation, if you're happy with whatever that water is doing, that also creates an approval, even though the approval is not necessarily connected to the zraim. So for instance, in our case over here, where you want the rain to wash the bowl, you're not actively putting the water there, the water is coming by itself. But you're happy the water is coming there because you want to wash the bowl. That water that's washing the bowl, if it's then deflected onto fruits, food items, then that water will be makshir the kabel tuma. So even though your mindset about this water had nothing to do with the food items, and you might even not want it on the food items, but nevertheless, since you wanted the water and you wanted it to wash the utensil that was there, that's enough to be considered your approval, and that water approval will affect the food items that it falls upon. Again, from the psukim, Rashi brings all these psukim down, we learn that hechsher the kabel tuma and the waters can only work if it's done to something that is talush. So if there's a bowl that is sitting on top of a wall, the bowl is something that's detached, talush, and that can generate the hechsher, the kabel tuma. So that's what the Mishnah is saying, that if you put the bowl upside down and you want it to get washed, then the water that falls away from that bowl or is deflected by that bowl, that will be makshir, the kabel tuma. On the other hand, if you put the bowl there to simply protect the wall, you don't want the water. You don't want the water hitting the wall, and beyond that, if it didn't come at all, you'd be just as happy because you're not trying to wash the bowl. Over there, if the water hits the bowl and then is deflected onto food items, there will not be makshir de kabel tuma, unless you have another thought afterwards, was when the liquid is on those items, you're happy with it. That's what Mishnah says, and Gemara points out, agufakasha, there's an internal stira in the Mishnah. Amart, bishvil shetudach. If you wanted to put the bowl there because you wanted to rinse it, harizeh b'chiyutan, then it qualifies to be makshir de kabel tuma. Habishvil shudacha kotel. On the other hand, if you wanted the wall to get washed, ein ze bichiyutan. That'd be the diuk that you would make from there. It's only because it's a detached item, it's a bowl, is it classified as something that creates hechsher the kabel tuma. But the wall, that would not create hechsher the kabel tuma. On the other hand, v'hadatani, in the latter half of the Mishnah it says, bishvil shelo yilakeh akotel. So that the damage doesn't happen to the wall, that's why you're putting the bowl there. Ein bichiyutan. Then it doesn't qualify to be makshir the kabel tuma. Ha, bishvil shudacha kotel. On the other hand, that means that if he did want the wall to be washed and not to protect it, harizeh b'kiyutan, that would have worked. And that would have been considered to be water that would be makshir the kabel tuma. So, how do you reconcile between those two items? So, Amar Rabbi Elazar, you can't. Tavro, the Mishnah has dual attribution. Misha shanazo, lo shanazo. Whoever brought the aloha in the beginning of the Mishnah is not the same author, same attribution as the second half of the Mishnah. Because the diok out of them is different. And therefore there is a machloket here as to what the status of a wall is. A wall is an object that is talush, was originally separated out, was bricks, was stones, lusof chibro, and then you put it back together and attached it to the ground. So the machloket between the first opinion in this Mishnah and the second opinion in the Mishnah is what's the status of a wall. is a wall considered to be talush, or is it considered to be mechubar? According to the Reisha of the Mishnah, the wall is considered to be mechubar. So only the bowl or water that came to wash the bowl can be classified as something that is qualified in the Heksha, the Kabbal Tuma. Whereas something that washes the wall does not have that status because a wall is considered to be mechubar. And something that's mechubar cannot generate Heksha, the Kabbal Tuma. When water falls on it, is deflected from it, can't create Heksha, the Kabbal Tuma. The Reseifa of the Mishnah says if you put the bowl there to protect the wall, then it's not considered to be something that is Makshir the Kabbal Tuma. On the other hand, if it was washing the wall, that would be Makshir the Kabbal Tuma, and it's clearly classifying the wall as something that is Talush. And if it's Talush, you can generate liquids that would be Makshir the Kabbal Tuma. If you want the wall to be washed and then it's deflected off the wall, those waters would be Makshir the Kabbal Tuma. So that's what Rava was saying. By the case of Hekshir the Kabbal Tuma, there's a Machloket Tanaim. And according to Rabbi Elazar's explanation of that Mishnah, it would be a machloket tanaim as to whether talush, the sof chibro, is classified as mechubar or talush. Although we have an alternative answer which says that it is not a machloket tanaim, which is Rapapa amar kula chad tanahu. That Mishnah is all written by one Tana. Ha bekoto mara, ha bekoto binyan. Depends about which wall you're speaking about. If you're speaking about a wall of a cave, that's considered to be chibro mikara. That's bedrock. You created the house by digging into the cave. Whatever stone and rock is still there is mechuber the karka. So that would be considered to be a wall that's mechuber the karka, and it can't generate heksha the kabbal tuma. On the other hand, if you're dealing with a kotel habinyan, that's considered to be talush to the sof chibro, and that has a din of talush. Vachikamar, hakofek hara al kotel, someone who puts a bowl upside down on a wall, bishvil to dudach, in order that the bowl gets washed. Harizeh bechiyutan, that's considered to be approval of the water, and it can be makshu the kabbal tuma. Hash bishvil shudach hakotel, but if it was to wash the wall, ain't zebichiyutan. That would not create waters or liquids that can be matched to the kabbal tuma, even though it has your approval. When's that true? Bamedra memorim bekotel mara. That's only true when you're dealing with the wall of a cave, because that's considered to be mechubar meikaro. Avokotel binyan, if it's a wall of a structure, bishvil shlo yilakeh hakotel, hu de'eno bichiyutan. Then only if you put the bowl there to stop it from being damaged, do we say that that's not considered to be waters or liquids that could be makshir the kabbal tuma? Ha bishvil shudach hakotel. But if it was for the wall to get washed or rinsed off, harizeh bechiyutan, that is sufficient to create heksher the kabbal tuma, because we classify the wall that was built as being something that is talush, and it will generate bechiyutan. And so that is the way that Rav Papa explains the Mishnah in order to make it not a machloket tanaim. And that way he says that everybody agrees here by Heksha the Kabbal Tuma that if it was Talush, the Sof Chibro, that would be considered to be Talush. Similar to what we said with regards to Avodah Zarah. So by Rava. But now Rava asks his question. He dealt with two areas of Aloha, Avodah Zarah, Heksha the Kabbal Tuma. Now he's dealing with Talush, the Sof Chibro, Linyan Shchita, Mai. What is the din with regards to Shchita? So Tosfot already asked, didn't we deal with this yesterday? Wasn't that the machloka between Rabbi Chia and Rabbi in the Braita? And the Gemara went through different iterations of trying to describe whether we think that it's Rabbi Chia l'chatchila, or do we think that it is Rabbi Chia l'bidiavad? How do we reconcile between the different possibilities? And the Gemara came to the conclusion that Rabbi Chia thinks it's kasher l'chatchila, and Rabbi believes that it's only kasher bidiavad. And that Rabbi's distinction between when it's kasher bidiavad and pasul was the difference between whether it was chibro miikara or talush or the sof chibro. So we already have an answer to this question. He says, v'yesh lomar, daliba de rabbi mibayle, he's asking Rabbi's position, to dilmavi ketalush ukshera. Maybe it should be classified as talush, and be kasher the gamre. Oshema, the rabbi, en chiluk ben talush to the sof chibro, le mechubar miikaro. Or maybe Rabbi makes no such distinction between them, and even talush le sof chibro should be pasul. Or in essence, Tosfot says that Rava disagrees with the conclusion of the Gemara before. And that does have a nafkamina halacha, as the Rosh notes, because over here, the Gemara never comes to a conclusion about the position of Rava. If that's the case, you'd have to be machmir, and that means that talush, the sof chibro, would be pasul de gamre, as opposed to the previous Gemara, which the conclusion was that it would be kasher, at least bidiavad, according to Rabbi. So Rava is at least opening up the possibility that we could have learned in a different manner. And since that's the case, he's now querying as to what Rabbi's opinion is. So Tashma, Hayatsur Yotzei Min HaKotel, we're quoting the Braita that we said at the end of yesterday's daf, that if there was some sort of flint stone coming out of the wall, Oshia Kaneh Ole Me'elav, or you have some reed that comes up of its own, shachat bo, and you use that for shchita, shchitato psula. There, the shchita is psula. So from there, it sounds like a stone. We're thinking that it's built into a wall, and that is talush, the sof chibro. And you're paralleling that with the case of the reed, which grew by itself, and that's mechuber the karka. Gemara says, there, you can't learn anything from that. How come my skin and bekoto me'ara? That's not speaking about a flint stone that was in a building. It's a flint stone that is coming out of a wall of a cave where it's bedrock. Dekanami, and I can prove that to you, dekani dumya dekaneo lemeyalav. Because the case that it's parallel to in the Braita is a case of a reed or something that grows on its own. So that's got to be speaking about here, something that's really mechubar mi'karo, something like a koto me'ara, shmamina. From there you can't prove anything about the talush or the sof chibro. So tashma, so it goes to an earlier part of that Braita where it says, na'at sakin bakotel. If you impale a knife in the wall, b'shachat ba, and then you use that for shchita, shchita tol k'shera. B'diavad, that shchita is good. So Gemara says, shani sakin de lo mevatale. That sakin, even though you impaled it in the wall, and it's talush, or the sof chibro, you now made it a part of the binyan, that's not really true. You didn't really make it a part of the binyan. You're not going to leave it there permanently, and you're not mevatel the knife to the binyan. That's not what people do. They still consider it to be a separate item. They don't consider it to be one of the walls of the house when the knife is impaled in it. So tashma. So again, another line in that braita. It says, b'mechuber lekarka, something that's attached to the ground, shchitato k'shera b'diavad. So there it sounds like you have to be speaking about something else besides the other two cases that we had over here. Different than mechubar meikaro, different than the knife where it's something that's not mevutal to the wall, but rather a case of mechuber lekarka where it's mevutal. It's talosh l'sof chibro and it's mevutal. Over there it says, b'diavad, it's kasher. Gemara says, dilma prushe kamefarishla. Maybe the case of the knife is explaining what the situation of mechuber lekarka is. My mechuber lekarka. What's classified as mechuber lekarka that's considered to be shchitato k'shera? That's a sakin. That's a knife, delo mevatale, because he's not mevatale. So then we originally thought mechuber lekarka was a different case. Gemara says, no, don't read it as a separate line item in the Braita, but rather as a more generic line in the Braita that is then followed up with the case of Sakin in the Braita to teach you what am I mean by Mechuber the Karka? I meant the Sakin. There it's Kasher B'diavad because the Sakin, you're not mevatel it to the wall. But again, we're still left without any indication as to what you do by Talush Ulusov Mechubar. So Amamar, Na'yatz Sakin Bakotel V'Shachapa Shkitato K'shera. Now we're going back to that Braita to deal with. If you impale the knife in the wall, and you did shchita with it, that shchita is okay. Amar Ravana Amar Shmuel, lo shanu ela shasakin lamalo, b'tzavara behema lamata. It's only true if the knife is above and the animal is below. Meaning that the blade is facing downwards and you're lifting up the animal and then moving the animal back and forth to do the shchita. Aval, but if the scenario is reversed, that the sakin is lamata, b'tzavara behema lamalo, the sakin is down below and its blade is facing upwards, and then you bring the animal, and now you're moving the animal back and forth on the knife from above. There, it's not good because chashinan shema idros. We're worried about the fact that you might put pressure on the knife. Idros is where, instead of making a cutting motion back and forth, and the sharpness of the knife is doing the shchita, through the pressure that you're placing on the knife towards the animal, that's what's generating the shchita. So when you are lifting up an animal or putting an animal above the knife and moving it back and forth, the weight of the head of the animal, the weight of the animal itself, is going to put downward pressure on the knife. And so therefore, even when you're moving it back and forth, it might be that you're doing drisa, and you might even be doing it unbeknownst because of just the weight of the animal. If you have it reversed, where you're bringing the animal up from below and then you're moving it back and forth, there you don't have the natural weight of the animal pressing up against the knife. It's just you doing the movement, and over there we don't worry about the problem of drisa. Tosva points out over here that in the Mechubar, Shmuel seems to indicate that afilu b'chiya gavna lo machshir ala b'diavad. In the case where the sakin is above and the behemah is below, he thinks it's only good b'diavad, which means that in the case where the behemah is above, it's pasul even b'diavad. If that's the case, the Bali Tosva would say he used the wrong lashon. Kasha, dimkein avalei demeimer chashinan shema daras. Kevin de ata lifsol b'diavad. It should have said that, not that he shema yidros, he might do the drisa. It should say shema daras to make it pasul even b'diavad. V'yesh lamar. Tefilo amar bori li shalo darasti. Even if he says, I know for sure that I didn't do drisa, we don't listen to him. Shema yidros pamacheret, because he might come to do drisa the next time. And that's why he says shema yidros. We don't consider his either declaration that he can do it or he didn't do it as being efficacious in this case. And therefore, no matter what, you're not allowed to do this, even if you think you can, or even if you said you did do it without drisa, it doesn't help. And that's why he used the lashon of Shema Yidros, that maybe you will do it in the future, because we don't rely on this type of shechita whatsoever. It's pasul even b'diavad. So here, Rav Hanan, in the name of Shmuel, makes a distinction between whether the knife is above or the knife is below. We have a braita that says there is no distinction. It doesn't matter whether the knife is below and the animal is above, or whether the knife is above and the animal is below. Both of those are kshirim b'diavad. So, Amar Rav Zvid, b'tzadim k'tani. That braita is not a braita that is saying that both mechubar and talush, you can do it in that manner, but rather, sakin lamato bitzavar beim lamalo, when you have the knife down below, and the animal above it, bitalush. Then if the knife is detached, that is a kosher shkita. We don't worry about drisa when you have control over the knife. On the other hand, sakin lamalo bitzavar beim lamato, the knife is above, facing down, and then you're lifting up the animal to do the shkita, moving it back and forth, be mechubar. Even in mechubar, that is kosher. That's the way he explains that braita not to be a problem for Shmuel, which is that the first part of the braita that says that if the knife is below and the animal is above, there it's only kasher if the knife is detached. And then the motion that you're doing is with the knife and not with the animal. Because over there, even though there could be drisa, but since you're in control of the knife, we don't worry about it. On the other hand, if the knife is implanted in the wall and you now move the animal back and forth above it, there we do worry about drisa, because the natural weight of the animal is pressing down on the knife. And then we wouldn't permit it over there. On the other hand, if it is where the knife is above and the animal is below, then we're indifferent as to whether the knife is doing the motion, it's talush, and you're moving the knife back and forth, or the knife is implanted in the wall and you're moving the behemah. Either one of those cases, it would be fine, and then the braita would be saying something similar to what Shmuel had indicated. But Papa Amar, but Papa says, no, the braita is speaking about Ba'ufad the Khalil. It's made a bird that's much lighter. There's a difference in a din between a bird and an animal. An animal weighs a lot. So then if you have the knife implanted in the wall and you're carrying the behemah above the knife back and forth, and that's how you're doing the shechita, the weight of the animal is going to affect the shechita and cause the drisa. Then if you're using a bird, which is very light, if you're moving the bird back and forth on the knife above it, it's no different than moving the bird back and forth underneath the knife. The bird doesn't weigh enough that you're just going to cause drisa. And therefore, in both those cases, we'll say that it is fine when it comes to birds. By behemah, by animals, we wouldn't say that. Now, even though the braita seems to use the term behemah, it doesn't mean behemah generically. It means a specific type of behemah. It means an oaf in this case. So the braita is speaking about a bird, where you can do it in either direction. Whereas Shmuel was speaking about a behemah, where you can only do it when you're coming from underneath. You can't do it when you're coming from above with the animal, because that weight will cause a problem of drisa. Amar Rav Chista, Amar Rav Yitzchak, Varmila b'matnita ta'ano. So we have a memra, either from the Amoraim, or some say it came from a braita. Hey dvarim nemu b'kurumit shel kaneh. There were five things that were said about a reed or a bamboo shoot. Ain't shochatim ba, you're not allowed to do shechita with it. Ve'ain malin ba, you can't do a brit milah with it. Ve'ain mechatchin ba basar, you can't cut up meat with it. Ve'ain mechatzitzin ba shinaim, you can't use it as a toothpick to clean out your teeth. And you can't use it as toilet paper. The assumption being here that all of these problems stem from the same issue, which is that the reed splinters. And since it splinters, it will cause problems in all these situations. In the case of shechita, it'll cause a ripping of the simanim, or chonkin. It will cause asphyxiation of the animal, rather than the cutting that you're looking for in terms of the shechita. By milah, it's dangerous. You're doing a milah with this sharp reed. If it leaves splinters, it can affect the member of the baby that you're doing the brit milah on. His member will be punctured by the splinters that are coming. That's dangerous. You can't cut meat with it because the splinters will be left in the meat unnoticed by you. And then you're going to come to eat it, and it's dangerous with these splinters of reed or wood that are found inside of the meat. Same thing with regards to teeth. Because it'll have splinters that pull away and then be left in your mouth or cut you in the mouth. And the same thing with using it as toilet paper. So that would seem to be the common reason as to why you can't use a reed for all these items. So the Gemara then says, "Ein shochatim ba?" Is that really true? You can't shech with it? Atanya, don't we have a braita that says, "B'chol shochatim," that you can do shechita with any item? Ben betzur, ben betzchuchit, ben bekrumit shel kaneh. You can even use a flintstone, glass, or a reed. And over here it says, "B'chol shochatim," which is the chatchila, that you can use it. Amar Rav Papa b'simona da'agma. It is this particular type of reed which doesn't splinter, which we will allow you to use. He says it's Esev Agadel Bagmei Amayim, Bikari Lishka. Rashi says it's a type of vegetation that grows near bodies of water. And when it dries out, it's extremely sharp. and it cuts without leaving any splintering behind. So there are some types of reeds which are problematic because they splinter. There are another species of reeds that don't splinter and they'll be fine. You know how to use it to cut meat with. On the other hand, Rapapa, even you're not allowed to use it for cutting meat, he does use it for cutting up fish, the zige, because they are clear. Since they have much lighter flesh, or they are even somewhat clear, as Rashi says, you look in Rashi, it says zig is clear, and he says, kamo mara, like a mirror, shikori midvar, that we call like a mirror. They're much clearer, much lighter, and therefore the splinters would be visible in them if they detached from the reed. So even though you won't use it for basar, which is darker, and it's hard to see the splinters in the meat after it's been cut, that's not true by fish. Rabba bar Rav Huna mechatech ba ofa, he would cut fowl with it, derokich, because the flesh of fowl is much softer. Since it's so soft, it doesn't cause the reed to splinter, it doesn't cause there to be enough friction that is going to release these splinters in there, as opposed to basar, which is much tougher, which does cause the item to splinter, and that's why you can't use it as a knife there. Ve'emikan chimba, you can't use it as toilet paper. Typically, why don't you say the problem here is mishum damar mar, ha'mekaneach b'davar sha'or sholetet bo, shinab no shrot. If a person uses for toilet paper any item that is flammable, something that can catch fire, that's dangerous in terms of using it. Seems to be it's something more in the spiritual realm, like a ruach ra'ah, than being a physical danger. But if you use something that's flammable, that can tear away at the skin, the flesh, or the ligaments that are around one's rectum. So why do you need to tell me you can't use it because of the fact that it splinters? You shouldn't be able to use it just because of the fact that it's something that is flammable. Samra papa. Kinuach over here does not mean using it as toilet paper, but rather kinuach piyamakeka me'inan. Speaking about rubbing it over a wound or an injury. If you're using it to cut above or to clean off a wound or an injury, you shouldn't use this because then it will splinter and go in or embed itself in the wound itself. So it's being about a wound and not about using it as toilet paper because it would have been disqualified from being used as toilet paper even if it didn't splinter because of the fact that it is something that or sholetet bo. That's dangerous in terms of using it. Seems to be it's something more in the spiritual realm, like a ruach ra'ah. Or it was an issue of kshafim, which we no longer worry about. Or if you really believe there was some physical danger from it, then the poskim tell us that came into dashu barabim. Since people do it now, like we use toilet paper without any consideration, then shomer p'tayim Hashem, we don't worry about this being an issue anymore because we, first of all, don't see that it's doing damage and everybody does it. And therefore we say, Shomer Pateim Hashem, we don't worry about it at all. Right, so now the Gemara continues and says, the mission says, Akol Shochatim, Olo Olam Shochatim. Everybody does Shchita, Olo Olam Shochatim. And you can do Shchita forever. Akol Shochatim, we translated in the Mishnah, that means anyone can do Shchita. But Rashi points out here, that can't be the meaning of Akol Shochatim because the Mishnah already told us, the Mishnayot earlier already told us who's qualified to do Shchita. That an Akum can't do Shchita, but a Jew can do Shchita, depending on what the status of the Jew is, what's the status of a Kuti. That's all laid out in the Mishnayot explicitly. So when it comes to say a Kol Shochatim over here, it can't be saying that anybody can do Shchita, but rather it has to be everything needs Shchita, which is a Kol B'Shchita, Afilu Of. Everything requires Shchita, even fowl. The reason that you may have thought otherwise is because the Pesukim only tell you about a Zavachta V'Achalta by Behema. It never mentions Of over there. So there's a possibility that you could believe that Shechita was only necessary by Behemot, not by Of. Misha comes to say, Akol Shochatim, that means everything requires Shechita, including birds. The Olam Shochatim, you always have to do Shechita, Mantana, who's the author of our Mishnah. Amar Rabba, Rabbi Shmohi, it's following the position of Rabbi Shmuel, the Tanya. The Braita tells us from the Pasuk in Dvarim that teaches us that you're allowed to shech animals bechulin and eat them basar tava. Says, ki achiv Hashem et vulcha, and Hashem expands your boundaries, kasher diberlach, v'amarta uchla basar. And then you're going to say, I want to eat meat. And then it teaches you the dinim of shechita. Not explicitly, but that's the halacha l'moshe misinai that we have from the meaning of the word v'zavacht there in the Pasuk. And it says, Rabbi Shmuel says about that, lo bakatuv, elahate lehem basar tava. That came to give them permission to eat basar tava, which is another way of saying basar chulin, in order to shecht animals, not bring them as korbanot and eat their meat. Shebet chila. When they were in the midbar, nasar lehem basar tava. They weren't allowed to eat any meat that was not a korban. Mishenichnesu la'aretz, once they entered into the land of Israel, hutalahem basar ta'ava, then they had the right to eat meat of chulin. Ve'achshav, shegalu, now that we went into galut, we were sent out of the land, yachol yachzeru le'isurun harishon. You would have thought maybe it goes back to the original status, which is that you're not allowed to have basar chulin. Kach shaninu, that's why the Mishnah tells us, le'olam shochatim, that you always do shechita. That means whether it is at the point when you go into Eretz Yisrael, or even after the point that we were put into galut, we still have a requirement of doing shechita in order to eat basar ta'ava. Not that you could have done nothing, but rather you wouldn't be able to eat basar ta'ava possibly when you went into galut. Now Rabbi Shmuel believes that in the midbar, you're not allowed to eat basar ta'ava. The only way you can eat meat is to bring a shlamim to the mishkan and then put the dam and the chilev on the mizbeach, and the basar then would be available for you to eat. That is true in the midbar because you don't have tirachi Hashem et gvulcha. That's the time where the meat of chulin basar tava became mutar, implying that before that it was problematic. And that's the way the Balei Tosafot learned, that the isur Rabbi Shmuel is stating is from basically an isur asay. The fact that it was matir basar chulin when you went into the Eretz implies that before that point in time it wasn't mutar, and that means that the only way you could get meat was through kodoshim. On the other hand, Rashi says something striking, which is she'enim yocholim lechol basar shlamim v'mayu shochatim b'lo korban. If you did shechita in the midbar and it wasn't a korban, hayu nashim bikaret, you would get a punishment of karet ichtiv al petach omoed lohivio. Or Rashi, in other words, says that if you shecht an animal outside of the mishkan in order to eat meat, that's the equivalent of shchutei chutz. According to Rashi, the default status of all animals in the midbar is kadosh. And since the default status is kadosh, if you would do shechita outside of the mikdash, which was relegated only to the mishkan and the midbar, you'd be chayav for shchutei chutz. Tosafot is unwilling to accept that. He says, why is it shchutei chutz? Shchutei chutz only applies to something that's kodesh, and then you shecht it outside of the mishkan. Who says here, these animals are kodesh? These animals are chulin. So why should you be chayav for shchutei chutz? And that's why Tosafot says the reasoning behind Rabbi Shmuel is not that it's classified as shchutei chutz, but rather simply, if you have a heter when you come into the land to eat basar tava, it implies until that point it wasn't mutar. And that's where the isur of basar tarabak in the midbar for shechting chulin comes and not bringing it as a korban. Although the Ramban al Torah does favor Rashi's interpretation and indicates that when it says here, you're not a der shchita chutz, it's any type of shkita, not just shkita by kodeshim, even by chulin. And it could be the combination of the two items, which is the fact that the Torah has to be matar basar ta'ava when you enter into Eretz Yisrael means that it was asur beforehand, or that it's classified in the world of shkitot that are asurot. And therefore the pasuk of shchutei chutz applies to any shkita asura, which when they were in the midbar included also shkitat chulin. So the combination of the psukim result in what Rashi is saying over here, and therefore there are Rishonim that back up what Rashi is saying, that there is a problem of shchutei chutz, and that is the source for the Isser in the Midbar, rather than the way that Balei Tosafot learned that the Isser derives from the fact that it was mutar when you came into the land, indicates it was asur until that point. So what Rabbah is suggesting is that the attribution of our Mishnah is to Rabbi Yishmael, and the reason he had to say Akosho Chatim is because you would have thought that the heter for Basar Tava is only in Eretz Yisrael, not when you go into Galut. Matki Flei Rav Yosef, so his Talmud Rav Yosef challenges him and says, Haido Olam Shochatim, that's not the right language to be put in the Mishnah that you can always do Shechita. The issue here is not Shechita. The issue is, Olam Shochatim Ve'ochlim Mibayilei. It should say that you always can do Shechita and eat it. There's no problem to do Shechita. The only question is the Shechita effective in making it something that's kosher to eat? So if the main focus is on the eating aspect, not the Shechita aspect of it, and so Olam Shochatim should be followed up with Olam Shochatim Ve'ochlim. That's the important thing that you're trying to teach us. Teaching us that you can always do Shechita, that's not really what you're looking for. Of course you can do Shechita. The question is, what is the impact of that Shechita you did? Is it a kosher Shechita? Or is it a Shechita Psula? So that's the real question, and that's determined by whether you can eat it or not. So that's what, first of all, the Mishnah should have said Olam Shochatim Ve'ochlim, and not just Olam Shochatim. Ba'od Mi'kara, Ma'itama Itzar. Why was it in the Midbar that they weren't allowed to eat in Basar Tava? Because they were very proximate to the Mishkan. Why is it that when they went into Eretz Yisrael, it is mutar to have basar chulin, basar tava, and not bring it as a korban? Because they were far away from the Mishkan, or in essence, far away from the Mikdash. And that's stated explicitly in the Psukim. Because it says, when Hashem expands your borders, And it says in the next pasuk, Ki yirchak mimcha makom, asher yivchar Hashem lekecha l'sum shmo sham. When it's too far away for you to get to the Mikdash on a daily basis, v'zavachta mibrachah mitzoncha, asher natan Hashem lecha, that's when you do the shchita of chulin, kasher tziviticha, that's the limud that teaches us alok l'moshe mitzinai about all the dinim of shchita, and then you can eat it as you please wherever you live. So the reason for being matir chulin and being matir basar tava was because of your distance from the Mikdash. And of course today, that we're even further away from the Mikdash. Now, that's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, because not only are we far away from the Mikdash, we don't even have a Mikdash at all. And so, clearly, if the heter for basar tava derives from your distance from the Mikdash, then certainly today, where we're more distant, and the Mikdash doesn't even exist, certainly basar tava should be mutar. So what type of reasoning is that, that you would have thought, or had a havamina, that it should go back to the way it was before, and that you can't do shkita? El Amar Rav Yosef, Rav Yosef offers his alternative, and says, the author of our Mishnah is Rabbi Akiva, Titania. Kirchak mimcha makom, asher yivchar Hashem lekecha l'sum shmo sham, v'zavachta mibakarcha mitzonecha. That's the pasuk that we just read. Rabbi Akiva Omer, lo ba katuv, elo lasur lehem basar nechira. The reason the pasuk is coming to teach you that you need shkita is to tell you that other forms of killing are no longer available to you. Shevet chila, in the midbar, hutar lehem basar nechira. They could eat basar nechira. Mishnechnesu laaretz, when they came into Eretz Yisrael, nesar lehem basar nechira. Then it became asur, which means that in the midbar, you had two choices. You could eat basar kodoshim and bring it as a korban. You could also eat basar tavar, basar chulin. There was basar tavar in the midbar, but the way you killed the animal wasn't necessarily shkita. The Gemara here mentions nechira. That could be for one of two reasons. It could either be because you demand nechira. Nechira is the cutting of the animal, according to many Rishonim, from the neck all the way down through the chest, and pulling a knife straight down that way. That's called nechira. Others just say that it's a type of killing that is not shchita. What Rabbi Akiva is saying is that in the midbar, there was no requirement of shchita for basar chulin. However, you killed the animal was sufficient or okay in order to make it that it's kasher meat. What changed when you went into Eretz Yisrael is now if you want to eat basar chulin, you need shchita. So what Rabbi Akiva says is the contrast between going into Eretz Yisrael and the midbar is when you're in Eretz Yisrael, the only way for the animal to be kasher when you kill it is to use shchita. In the midbar, that wasn't the case. There wasn't v'zavachta. You could eat it any way you please, meaning no matter how it was killed, you could eat it. That's the change that went on. Obviously, Rabbi Shmuel disagrees, and Rabbi Shmuel says the change that happened was that there was no basar chulim in the midbar, and only once you entered the Eretz Yisrael is there a heter of basar chulim whatsoever. So now we're going to say, v'chshav shigalu, now that we're in galut, yachol yachzeru li heteran arishon. You would think it goes back to the original heter. It seems that only when you're in Eretz Yisrael is the requirement of shchita. When you're outside of Eretz Yisrael, when you're in the midbar, there's no requirement of shchita. So we would have thought after the Churban, or in the time of Galut, that it wouldn't be any requirement of shchita. Lakach shaninu, that's why the Mishnah tells us, the olam shochatim, that even post Churban Abayit, or even in the Galut, there's still a requirement of shchita. Once Basar Chulin requires shchita, that's a permanent situation, that's a permanent state of affairs, and you always have to do shchita, and we don't go back to the original heter in the midbar to eat it, even without shchita. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Yud Zayin Amud Aleph.